This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Hello and welcome to Scientist Warning TV. And today I'm delighted to be talking again with Professor Bill Maguire, so academic, activist, broadcaster and blogger, and Emeritus Professor of Geophysical and Climate Hazards at UCL. And Bill has in recent years become a prolific writer, communicator and advocate. He's the author of numerous books, including Skyseed, which is a cautionary tale and a very interesting tale about the hazards of geoengineering. And then recently he wrote a new book, Hothouse Earth, in which he writes that the post-COP26 reality is this: to have even the tiniest chance of keeping the global average temperature rise below 1.5 degrees C, we need to see emissions down 45% by 2030. And in theory, this might be possible. But in the real world, barring some unforeseen miracle, it isn't going to happen. Now, that's going to be a very triggering statement for some. I just wondered if you'd like to comment on that.
Well, some people may be concerned about it, but that's simply a fact. I don't know why people are still going on about 1.5 degrees C when at the same time they talk of needing a 45% cut in emissions. I mean, the two things just don't go together. We've got something like 90 months to reduce emissions by nearly a half when there's been no sign of a reduction of in emissions globally ever. Apart from a little blip when COVID-19 really hit home. So, it's just not sensible and it's not right to keep giving the impression that we can stay this side of 1.5 degrees.
You know, this debate around 1.5 and whether we should, whether it's dead in the water, as some yourself and others like Kevin Anderson would say, it's become controversial because there's almost a sense in which, some scientists are hanging on to the fact that it's still geophysically possible. In fact, it may not be. And it's the sense in which we have to hang on to the possibility, because without that as a possibility, it seems, I think there's a fear that there will be despair and that people will give up and that we'll be in an even worse position. And it's something that perhaps we can return to, because it's something you talk about in your book about this, the importance of being truthful and being brutally honest about where we really are. None of the world's biggest economies, which together generate 80% of carbon emissions, are on target to keep the promises they made in Paris. So before we actually go on to talk about the book, I just would like to get your views on where we are now in terms of the Paris goal. I mean, you've just said that, you think it's lost. But of course, people will say that, every fraction of a degree matters. So where are we in terms of the science?
Oh, I think we have lost 1.5 degrees because countries simply aren't doing enough. I mean, some are doing better than others. The UK is doing moderately well, although when it counts its emissions reductions, it doesn't tend to count aviation and shipping and those emissions associated with consumerism. So even we aren't doing as much as we need. And many other countries have hardly changed at all. So Paris is dead in the water. 1.5 degrees is dead in the water. And to be honest, 1.5 degrees has sort of become this iconic landmark, which is supposed to equate to dangerous climate change. But there's no evidence that 1.5 degrees coincides with dangerous climate change. It could easily be 1.4. It could be 1.6. So to give it this massive relevance, it is really a bit misleading. And as you said just now, every 0.1 degree centigrade is critical. So we need to, we need to act to keep temperatures as low as we possibly can, but not get hung up on a target that we're not going to reach.
Yes, and you're right, because if there is a growing consensus that that target is in fact lost, then it does beg the question, well, what's the new target? Should there be a new target? It shouldn't be 2 degrees, clearly, but, it's a very dangerous zone into which we're straying. And I think you're absolutely right that the fixation on a target has been really deeply problematic all along.
There's a point of view that a bad target is worse than no target at all. All the targets that we have to choose from are all bad, effectively. And all we can do is cut emissions as fast as we possibly can. And that needs huge leadership from governments across the planet, which just isn't there yet.
You're right. And although in nations like the UK and US, there's a lot of talk, there's a lot of fine talk, as Greta would say, fine words, but it's really not translating into action. And you could say arguably in the UK with the new prime minister and talking about, resuming fracking, we'll just heading in the wrong direction, which is terrifying. But in Hot House Earth, which is a book which is both eloquent and really terrifying, and you give a very clear sense that things could get much worse, really very much worse, if the radical transformation that's actually called for in the IPCC reports doesn't happen. Now, if some heating is already baked in, and as many people say it is, including the UK's Committee on Climate Change, what can we expect between now and 2050 if we sort of trundle along this trajectory that we seem to be on?
Well, the reason the book's called An Inhabitant's Guide is because many people around today are going to be living in a world with these new conditions. We got a glimpse of it in this summer because we saw these incredible heat waves across Europe and North America and many other parts of the world. We saw catastrophic floods as far apart as Nigeria, Pakistan, the US, all over the planet, really. And the staggering thing is how quickly a small global average temperature change is translating into extreme weather. It's happening far more quickly, I think, than anybody expected. So we're going to see in the decades ahead more of the same. I mean, every year now we're seeing baking summers across the planet. The temperatures are going to get up to 50 degrees C plus in Europe, maybe as early as next year if it's an El Nino year. And of course, they've already got up to over 48 degrees now. Similar conditions will become more and more common across land areas right across the planet. And just really, things will start ramping up in terms of extreme weather. So the infrastructure will start to suffer, communications, transport, water supplies. Obviously, drought is going to be a massive problem in the future. And the UN just said the other day that 345 million people this year are marching towards starvation. Mm. Also, we've got food shortages predicted in the UK and France. And another report just last week suggested that in half of the world's countries, civil unrest could be expected in the next few months, including in the UK, because of a conspiracy, really, of energy problems, food prices, inflation, and the impacts of climate change. Now, that, you know, we're already seeing what we're going to see later on this century. It's just what we've been experiencing at the moment, only writ much larger.
Exactly. And these things are just coming down the tracks at us right now. They're actually here and now and affecting us here and now. I read today a very strange article again in The Guardian about some sort of brain eating amoeba, the prevalence of which had increased due to the increase in temperatures. It's one of those strange headlines, sort of do a double take and then think, gosh, well, how many other unforeseen, unexpected and really strange and very deeply unpleasant things are coming down the tracks, but we've not yet got sight of them.
Yeah, well, there are things that in the book I call stings in the tail, and some people may have heard of these. We're talking about the shutdown of the Atlantic conveyor, the Gulf Stream, and the other currents that keep Western Europe and the UK warmer than it otherwise would be. That is in a state of almost complete instability at the moment, and it could begin to slow dramatically or fail, certainly within the next 80 years, maybe sooner than that. Then you have the issue of thawing permafrost in across the tundra of Siberia and Canada, and this idea of giant methane burps, which can produce huge amounts of methane, pump it out into the atmosphere very quickly. Now, there's no evidence that happened in past episodes of heating, but you know, the absence of that evidence isn't evidence of absence. So we really don't know how the methane is going to behave. And of course, methane is 86 times more effective at warming the planet than carbon dioxide. Yeah. And then you have other things, an area which I've worked on, which is where you lose a lot of ice or you raise sea level considerably, you actually change the stress patterns within the crust so that you can promote earthquake activity, you can promote volcanic activity. So you may actually have a geological response to climate change as things really start to ramp up. So yes, there are lots of what you might call known unknowns, but there are unknown unknowns as well. And of course, we don't know what they are.
It's absolutely. And the one about the volcanoes that you write about in your book about the rising sea level and how that sort of will affect one side of a volcano. And then the magma then erupts a bit like toothpaste, I think you say in the book.
Yeah.
It's a very powerful image. But of course, it raises other questions, too, around the fact that, you know, we're kind of to what you might call a standard volcanic eruption. We know what to expect when volcanoes erupt. But under these changed circumstances, would that change the nature of the eruption? Would it amplify it? Would it lead to more devastation? I mean, I know you're a volcanologist, so perhaps it's something that you could comment on.
The idea is that changes in the stress regime within the crust would cause volcanoes that had magma already sitting there to erupt that magma earlier than they would otherwise. So you could get a clustering of eruptions that were ready to go. But it's the earthquake situation that's more worrying. Where you've had 2 or 3 kilometres of ice sitting on top of active faults, and that ice melts rapidly, you can trigger huge earthquakes. If we go back to the end of the last ice age, when big faults in Scandinavia were being unstressed, if you like, by the removal of ice, you had magnitude 8 earthquakes. That's as big as we see normally around the Pacific Rim, around the Ring of Fire. And a big worry is Greenland, because it's in exactly the same situation as Scandinavia was 10,000 years ago. If that ice starts to melt rapidly, the crust underneath starts to bounce back, which it already is doing, incidentally, in the Greenland area. That results in a lessening of stresses on faults. And if there are faults underneath there, they won't have moved for hundreds of thousands of years. So they could generate massive earthquakes, which could produce submarine landslides, and that in turn could produce tsunamis. This has happened at the end of the last ice age. So there are these sorts of things which people aren't really that aware of, which could result in massive threats.
Yes, and it all adds up to a terrifying near-term future. So you were at the centre of the controversy when The Guardian published an article that you had written, but they produced the headline for it. Have there been expressions of relief in the sense that you are now publicly saying what some scientists privately feel and believe?
Well, the article was really interesting. It was in The Observer, actually, rather than The Guardian. And it was written by a reporter. It was written by Robin McKee, who's an excellent journalist. And the article was accurate, entirely accurate, and described what my book was about and what I said to him. The problem was the headline was in two parts, and the second part said something like, "Total climate meltdown is now unstoppable," which isn't what I said, and it's not what the article said. And that only appeared on the online version. And it wasn't in the newspaper. And it did cause a little bit of consternation, although I have to say I've had very little comeback from climate scientists. Maybe one or two made comments on Twitter, and I just replied that I had nothing to do with the headline, and that's not what the article says or the book. And people were quite happy with that. They said something like along the lines of, "Oh, I'm glad to hear it." And the article headline was changed just a few days later. Everybody seem to have been reasonably happy. And I've had no people contact me saying that my stand at 1.5 degrees is not practically possible, is out of order. No one has said that.
That's interesting, because it does speak to that point about, privately, your colleagues, those in the scientific community will concur with you. But it's just the fact that publicly so few people are prepared to say that. And it's this scientific reticence, perhaps. Perhaps it's this feeling of responsibility. Perhaps it's this feeling of scientists aren't supposed to give opinions. They're supposed to be independent. They're supposed to stick with the facts. And it's a difficult one, because if scientists can't speak out, be advocates, or in your case, activists and advocates too, then who else can? Because the public are obviously looking for some guidance on this matter, and they're clearly not getting the guidance from politicians. So where can that guidance be found?
Well, we're not talking about some academic exercise here. We're talking about the future of our planet and our society. Everybody working in the field who thinks 1.5 degrees is no longer possible should be saying that. There's no excuse for it. If people are concerned that, it might affect their grant application outcomes or their peer review, peers may laugh at them or whatever, those are secondary issues. They don't even register on the radar, given the desperate straits that we're in. So everyone has a duty to do this. And I know many scientists are still coming out and saying this. I mean, Scientist Rebellion have a lot of great guys in there who support this idea. It's not an idea. I mean, you just need to look at the figures and know it's going to happen. But there is support out there, and it's growing, I think.
I think you're right. I'd like to come back to that point when we look at the relationship between knowledge, the privilege of being an academic, and the responsibility that goes with that. But I want to just touch on something that you mentioned about the La Nina events and so forth. So we've just been announced that we have just entered the century's first 3-year La Nina event. And given the rarity of such an event, perhaps 4 in a century, next year would seem set to swing towards a hot La Nina phase, which could raise global average temperatures in the short term over the next El Nino phase. So given the recent extreme weather events and record-breaking temperatures, and there's been quite a proliferation of workshops and events centering on tipping points, should this give us significant additional concern into next year?
Yeah, I think we should be really concerned, because the three-year La Nina is very unusual. It might extend into the early part of next year, but then it may well switch to El Nino conditions, which means a much hotter equatorial Pacific. And that is always also associated with a much hotter planet overall. Now, over the last 5 years, the average global temperature rise compared to pre-industrial times is just a shade under 1.3 degrees C. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't be at all surprised if you had a really strong El Nino following up next year and maybe the year after. I wouldn't be surprised to see 1.5 degrees broken during that event. It would probably be temporary, but, you know, 5 years now of almost 1.3 and then a 1.5, we're getting to that time when we will see a 1.5 degrees C increase being maintained over many years. In other words, we'll have broken through that barrier. I wouldn't be surprised to see us through it within 10 years.
Yes, and that's shocking. And an observation made to me by a scientist some months ago is that, yeah, experiencing 1.5 degrees on the way up, if we accept that we're going to overshoot, will not necessarily be the same as experiencing a return to 1.5 degrees on the way back down again, because we might have crossed a number of tipping points.
Exactly.
Which is perhaps something that, yeah, you know, that the public isn't perhaps as aware of as they might need to be.
Yeah, well, as you say, as the temperature ramps up, if we cross tipping points, like, for example, the loss of the Greenland ice sheet, even if we bring the temperature down by whatever means we do, and there's no certainty that we can even do that, that tipping point will stay tipped. So, you know, the Greenland ice sheet would go. Yes. And the other point is, the maximum temperature we reach, we will hang around at that temperature for several decades, maybe centuries. So you know, things aren't going to come down again unless we take carbon out of the air in a wholesale manner, which is another huge can of worms we probably don't want to open at the moment.
Exactly. And it brings me to another point, which is that, I mean, it must be extremely confusing for the public and perhaps for some policymakers when within the scientific community there are these divided opinions, with a number of scientists talking about the implausibility of carbon capture and storage, the problems associated with trying to scale something like that. And on the other hand, there are other scientists, some here in Cambridge, who talk about geoengineering. As if it's something that's feasible. And so given that there are at times these quite divergent views expressed by experts within the scientific community, it's hard to see, you know, how to reconcile those views and how those views could be reconciled in such a way that they make sense to those on the ground who are making decisions. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I tend to find that climate scientists are not supporters of geoengineering, but engineers are, and maybe to some extent physicists, because they like to tinker, whereas climate scientists can look and see what sort of havoc we've already caused by tinkering with the climate. But there's one thing that affects all these geoengineering schemes, and that is that they may work okay on a small scale, but to roll them out globally, to such a degree that they will counteract 40 billion tons of carbon dioxide being released every year, is just staggering. I mean, an initiative like that is comparable to an initiative which would slash emissions, and we're finding it very difficult to do that on a global scale. So how the hell are we going to, at the same time, launch a global geoengineering scheme that is, you know, is frankly just, It's a distraction from what we really need to do. It tackles the symptoms and not the cause of global heating. And we don't need distractions now.
Exactly. And I wonder if it's, you know, if that kind of techno-optimism sort of harks back to the 1960s when, you know, people thought, well, if we can get a man on the moon, you know, surely we can crack this one. But
it was people like Edward Teller who were originally very keen on weather engineering, and that was so that it could be used as a weapon of war. So, you know, that's where it all came from originally. And it's just, as I said earlier, a can of worms we just don't want to open.
And we don't have to. This is the rub. We don't have to, because the solutions and what we need to do is blindingly obvious. It's staring us right in the face. As you say, it's about slashing carbon emissions immediately. So going back to the book, at the end of the book, you describe two alternative scenarios for an August bank holiday weekend in London, one of which depicts the blistering hot days with temperatures reaching 44 degrees C, which just sounds horrendous, with everyone having to stay inside their homes to avoid the heat. You talk about the thick clouds of dust and the River Thames just being awash with sewage. And it's an absolutely horrible, nightmarish vision. You contrast this with another vision in which we have a picture of it's a green and lively city. It's busy with bicycles, with public transport, with people walking around in parks and with the streets barely visible because of the canopy of trees. And it's devoid of pollution of cars because the adaptations that we need to make now have actually been made. And in reading those two visions, obviously one of them is much more appealing, clearly. But what occurred to me was that for the average member of the public, neither of those scenarios would seem to be something that they would have in mind. They wouldn't necessarily seem to be recognisable. And it seems that just as, you know, sort of denialism and doomism and so forth would lead a minority of people towards the more apocalyptic vision. But for some people, that would be something that would not be entertained. But the one of the radical transformation, it seems to me, similarly, would not necessarily be entertained, because we don't have sufficient people talking about those sort of new visions about how society could be. I mean, you've obviously done this in your book. You know, other people like Paul Chatterton, for example, you know, talks about the ways in which cities could be transformed. So it's a really big question. But what are we going to do to change this?
Well, it's on the one hand, I've always thought that we're not going to see major action on emissions until the impacts of dangerous climate breakdown become so apparent that they simply can't be avoided, and their effect on economy and society become huge. Now, the problem with that is that it's probably not going to happen until temperatures are heading towards 2 degrees C. Mm-hmm. So it would be too late then to stop, you know, pretty calamitous climate breakdown. But there's nothing I can see which is going to make today's world leaders and today's governments change in order to slash emissions by half within 10 years and bring emissions down to zero, net zero by 2050, which in any case is too late, really. I just can't see that happening. It's a pessimistic viewpoint, and I hope I'm wrong, but no, I've always thought this. Governments won't change, world leaders won't change until they're forced to, or until their people force them to.
Absolutely. And, you know, and there was great hope with Extinction Rebellion that the Extinction Rebellion numbers would grow and that the pressure would come via that huge movement. And it's disappointing that it hasn't happened yet. I mean, like you, I'm sure, but, you know, I still hope that they will be part of creating that really important social tipping point that we need.
That was Alison Green from Scientists Warning with Dr. Bill McGuire, author of the new book Hot House Earth, An Inhabitant's Guide. Find links to the full YouTube presentation, Scientists Warning and Bill's book in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening this week, for better or for worse, and thank you for caring about our world.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.